Hello, welcome to another edition of the Late Fitness Test. I'm your host, Stel, and my two co-hosts, as ever, are Ben Dinery and Johnny Wilson. Ben, how you doing, mate?
Very good, Stel. Very good, my friend. And how are you?
Yeah, all good. It's a Friday, so I don't know what
certainly
that means.
Is.
Don't know what that means anymore, to be fair, because, well, has anyone gone back to work?
Yeah, well, we're another day closer to the resumption of the Premier League. So the return is on the horizon. There's light at the end of the tunnel. So it's all good. I'm really looking forward to that.
Mate, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm actually fed up of football. I've done too many podcasts in the past 3 months. Ridiculous.
I'm just looking forward to a little bit of normality in your life. Things have been up in the air for the last three months or so. So, you know, to get back into football and get back to doing some actual real work, I'm quite looking forward to it.
Excellent.
I'm not sure how long that will last, though. There's no guarantees.
5 minutes. Johnny! Mr. Wilson.
Hello, everybody. I am absolutely fantastic, on top of the world. What would I say? COVID is on the... I suppose people are learning to live with it now. And I had a great week presenting online webinar out in Iceland on all things ankle injury. So if you want to find a little bit more about that, drop me a DM on somewhere, either Twitter or... I'm probably doing the stuff that I should be doing at the end of the show now, really, aren't I? Rather than start the show. What I should be saying is I'm really excited about today's show, which I am. And I can't wait for it. So, I'm going to hand over to you, Stel, to intro the show.
Excellent. Well, without further ado, our guest is a lecturer in sport and exercise psychology at the Abate University. He's a doctor of philosophy in educational psychology, a master of science in sports psychology, and a bachelor of science in physical education and sports. Now, that's a mouthful. It's Louis Calmero. Louis, tudo bem?
Hello, everyone. Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for your invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward for this chat.
Great stuff. How's my Portuguese?
Could be better.
No comment.
He got me. There's me trying to be clever.
So Portuguese?
No, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's just it sounds more like French, if you don't mind saying so.
Ah, that's all right. I could do a French accent. I could do a German accent. I can't do a Portuguese accent, obviously, but there you go. Right, so Louis, thank you for joining us, mate. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get to where you are right now?
I've always been involved in sports since I was a kid, playing handball. Handball was my sport. So I did an undergrad in physical education and sports. Played handball for 19 years. Had my share of injuries. My area when I was studying, I finished my undergrad and then I started teaching in higher education. And my area was actually physiology, but I was also a coach, a handball coach, and it was just fascinating to see how different athletes would react differently to, you know, the same cues and being afraid of shooting to the goal and missing, so on and so forth. So I thought that I need to know more about sports psychology. So that's when I enrolled in in my master's degree, and it was just fascinating. So after that, I kept doing my coaching, also playing. I was teaching physical education at school. I was teaching a number of topics in the College of Education as well. So I decided then I want to go abroad to have a different experience, and then I went to Idaho for my PhD. Midway, I swapped to Florida State, and I completed my PhD, came back to Europe, and I found this job here in Abate, which where I've been for the last 13 years, basically. So in a nutshell, quite a few experiences and quite a journey.
So did you want to be a lecturer? Was this something that you were interested in?
No, actually, I mean, when I first initiated, I wanted to be a coach.
Right.
So I was very keen in continuing in coaching, but I think that things just developed. When I did my master's degree, it was like entering in a different dimension, a different zone. So I really understood better in terms of my athletes' reactions, my impact as a coach in my athletes' reactions. So I decided to pursue that area, and my master's degree went very well. So I started having invitations to deliver courses, and I thought, no, actually, this is quite fun, and it's also the aspect of constantly learning. So that's something that I've always been passionate about. So I thought, well, I will try it. I kept to lecturing at college level in my hometown as I was teaching and as I was coaching and actually still playing handball at that time. So little by little, I started to explore different avenues, and I guess that I didn't plan to be a lecturer, but that it happened basically. I think I would be equally happy if I had pursued my career as a coach. And
Excellent.
initially, that's what I wanted to do. As I thought that going to the US, doing my PhD, coming back to Portugal, and continue life as usual. Well, that didn't work out very well, simply because life was not the same, obviously.
And I know you co-wrote Kids Screen Child and Parent Instrument Portuguese versions. What's all that about?
Well, that was an instrument to measure types of relationships, for example, children have with parents, with the community, with peers. It also focuses on aspects of health behaviors. So it's within the area of identifying children's and adolescents' health behaviors and see how well they are adjusted in their lives. So it's more in the area of health psychology, child development.
Oh, that's fair enough, because the one thing I've noticed with my daughter, she's been at home for a good few months and she's becoming more of an adult, and she's six. So yeah, I think that's what happens when children aren't at school and they spend too much time with older people.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult for them to adjust, and it's difficult for us to adjust as well. But I think that the fact that the children's routines have totally changed, and as they have less contact with their peers going to school eventually, that really changes the way they operate on a day-to-day basis, and the way they relate to us as parents as well. I think it's quite a really nice opportunity as well for us to get more in touch with our parental roles on a, not just on a daily basis, but on a moment-to-moment basis, because they are with us all the time. So it's quite challenging.
Yep, absolutely.
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
Fantastic. Well, welcome to the show, Louis, first of all. I looked at your resume and your academic and working career, and it's very, very impressive. Eu aprender português desde ano atrás.
Oh, look at this guy trying to show me up.
Es que es muito palavra. So I was learning, what I was saying there was I was trying to learn Portuguese about 10 years ago. I went out to Brazil, and surfing is my passion in life. So I spent a year in Brazil, and I decided not to talk any English, you know. And then I'll often go down to Portugal, down to the south, just past Faro, out Sagres. There's a little village out there called Sagres, and
Yes.
it's great for surfing and all that. So it is. But anyway, I digress. A lot of our audience will be fantasy football related, and there'll be physios and sports scientists and sports therapists who work in professional sport, mainly in soccer. And a lot of these people then work with youth athletes. And There's been a real kind of infiltration of sports psychology into youth sport, especially in around the Premier League, Championship, League One. A lot of these athletes will have access to a sports psychologist. Could you just kind of outline the role, if this is an appropriate question, of the role of sports psychology for youth athletes from 16 years age onwards?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are two major roles. One is educational in nature, and that is a very important role in the sense that it helps athletes to improve their performance, to develop skills that they can use to improve performance, coping with difficulties, maintaining motivation, maintaining or increasing self-confidence, using imagery so they can develop a sense of commitment towards their sport, self-talk, being able to work themselves out of a difficult situation during competition. All these skills that are related with performance improvement, but also may have an impact in other domains of their lives. So this educational role is I think it's very important. Another role is more of the clinical sports psychologist per se, which is making sure that the athletes are well taken care of, is a sense of duty of care. It's not typical of or exclusive of the clinical sports psychologist, obviously, but the clinical sports psychologist deals more with issues that are associated with mental health. So making sure that the athletes are well adjusted, if they are experiencing issues of depression, anxiety, drug addiction, so on and so forth, any problems associated with their mental health, so the sports psychologist can flag and provide the duty of care. The educational approach tends to be more frequent, and I think that it has a really huge impact in the way they are able to progress through their career as a 16-year-old to 17, 18-year-old, and then that period when there is a lot of uncertainty if they want to proceed to a professional career. So these transitions are very important. So I think that a sports psychologist can help the athletes progress through those stages. So in a nutshell, this is the general role.
Thank you for that. So moving a little bit granularly, now that we've kind of defined a couple of the roles that a sports psychologist may play in youth sport, what would be some mechanisms for self-coping strategies that 16, 17, 18-year-olds might do? Let's say that they don't have either, number one, they don't have the support of a sports psychologist at their club, or they're not at a club which has that. Or number two, that maybe that they're not ready to open up to somebody yet. What are kind of the self-help coping strategies that somebody might be able to trigger?
Mm-hmm. Well, you raise a really important issue, which is when athletes are not really ready to seek out help. Because there is this myth that if you need a sports psychologist, that's because there is something wrong with you. And so that is very important for young athletes to realize that that is not the case. So that would be probably the first barrier that athletes will need to, or sports psychologists will need to overcome. Actually, that's not just the role of the sports psychologist. For example, the coaches also have a very important role in setting up the culture of the working environment, where the sports psychologist could be an important part. So what is that athletes can do? Well, athletes can learn how to self-regulate their emotions. They can use deep breathing. They can use strategies that allow them to keep focusing on the present. So the breathing is very important. Often when they are playing, they may be out of focus. They may be angry because of a poor decision of the referee or just because someone tackled me. So the breathing is the first step for you to regain control. You may not control many things in your environment, but that's something that you can control. So this will help to keep your mind focusing on something that you can control. So if I can use deep breathing, and I immediately experience that effect in my body, which is I will become calmer. So this means I then can address the problem at hand. So those are the basic strategies of deep breathing. For example, using self-talk, being able to stop negative thoughts and swap it into more positive, more helpful thoughts. They can be taught how to set goals, specific goals that they want to achieve. They can use imagery, so they can imagine themselves in a difficult situation during a game, and they can imagine themselves being successful in that situation, being successful in maintaining their emotional state and coping with that situation. So usually there are these types of strategies that we call emotion-focused strategies, that it's to control your emotional state, and problem-focused coping strategies, that is, you deal exactly with the problem. But sometimes we cannot deal with the problems because our minds are too clouded with the negative thoughts and the negative emotions that are associated with those thoughts. So strategies of emotional focus and coping and problem-focused coping are very important for athletes to develop. And that is something that they can actually use in other domains of their lives. I'm thinking, for example, when I was doing my master's degree, I was working with one team, and I was teaching some of these athletes to use deep breathing and so on and so forth. And one of the athletes actually told me that he was able to use that strategy when he was having an argument with his father. So he was very happy because it gave him a sense of control over his reaction, and that created a better environment for him to sort out the problem.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So talk to me, and let's get a little bit practical in this, okay? The use of goal-directed self-talk, you mentioned about that. So we've got situations where, you know, you're a youth athlete, you're going through your 2 years of your scholarship. My experience is that when they get 16 years of age, they sign the scholarship, they take the foot off the accelerator and they go into this pack mentality. And if you do a little bit more than the group, you're known as busy. And I'm always saying to young players, 16, 17, 18 year olds, now is the time to drive forward. Now is the time to goal set. And it kind of lasts a little bit for them, you know, but they don't, you know, and the majority don't stick the journey. And then you see this high dropout rate in professional soccer with regards to the age of 16 to 21, 22. Not an awful lot of these kids get through. So if we were to start from a mindset point of view and from goal-directed self-talk, you know, for the players, for the coaches, for the parents out there, for the sports therapists, sports scientists, fitness coaches who are working with these young athletes, you know, how do they talk to them, and what are the practicalities of doing this goal-directed self-talk?
Well, I think that, I mean, when they get to that stage, I think that the first thing that would be important for them to develop is a sense of a vision for themselves. What is their mission? What is it that they want to achieve? So sometimes if you reach a particular goal, then there is this time, almost this time of you know, slowing down, as you said, like, okay, I've achieved this goal. So there is a period almost of deflated motivation. So I think at this point, it would be really important to have a conversation with the athletes, having a workshop with the athletes, and try to ascertain what is it that what is their vision for themselves. One thing that just an example of something that I've seen sports psychologists doing with younger athletes is they can actually ask them to draw in a paper, in the middle of the paper, an image that represents what they want to be in their professional career, for example, and then in the corners, four more drawings that indicate what kinds of things do they have to do to achieve that central goal. So basically, in a fun way for children and adolescents as well, what they are doing is that they are creating their vision. And in an interactive way, because then they can discuss these things with each other in the team environment if they wish to do so. And we are also creating a culture of achievement as well.
Let's say, for example, you've got a youth athlete, right, who's mm-hmm. very outcome-driven, okay? So
yes.
they participate in this task, right?
Yes.
And they draw a picture of the end result. Now, the end result, and I see this happening, so this is an actual case scenario here, but mm-hmm. it's multiple case scenarios. So they talk about the car they're going to drive. They talk about the house they're going to own. They talk about how they're going to look after their parents. They talk about, mm-hmm. you know, how famous they're going to be and so on and so forth. But they're, you know, there's no kind of process behind it, and yes. and the vision is very kind of materialistic. It's very kind of, you know, driven by I want this or I want that. Then I find myself kind of intervening, and I'm never too sure if I should intervene, because they've written down what it looks like. You've given them that task to do. They put down the outcome, and you go, okay, right. Well, maybe that's a good start. Do I intervene here and say, all right, okay, well, that's okay, but you know, what about the process? What about, you know, where do you get to these goals and so on and so forth? Do you intervene or is there a bit more of guided discovery here?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a key point. It's about the guided discovery. I mean, there is nothing wrong in athletes developing a sense of outcome, like having their outcome goals. The problem is when they only have outcome goals and they don't focus on the process. So it's okay if I want to achieve this particular outcome goal. Fine, it's there. It's for you to achieve, to reach. But then you need to focus on the processes that will take you there. So that's where you develop this sense of, this staircase approach. Okay, so this is what you want to be in 5 years. What kinds of things that you need to do to get there. So when you ask that, rather than saying, for example, well, this is an outcome-related goal, so it's like almost removing the validation of the relevance of this goal, so we don't want to do that. But okay, so this is where you want to do, where you want to be. So what kinds of things do you have to go to? What kinds of things do you have to do? So this will allow them to start thinking in terms of the process, and then you narrow it down more in terms of solutions to achieve those particular outcomes. So you can actually facilitate thinking in terms of the process by this process of guiding discovery, definitely. I don't know if I answer your question.
Roundabout way, right? Yeah, getting there, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'd like to kind of discuss now is the, you know, where's this correlation between psychological stress and as a risk factor with injury, and especially with youth athletes or adult athletes? I mean, so the stresses of, and you don't have to be a professional athlete to be under psychological mm-hmm. stress. I played for the Dog and Duck, right? And I think we were in like the third round of the local village cup, you know, and I'm not sure I dealt with the stress very well. Is there, I'm guessing it's going to have a huge impact on performance, but is there any robust research to say that psychological stress can increase your risk of injury?
I think the evidence is strong. The idea behind this, I mean, there's a model developed by Anderson. And what they do is the idea is that the well, we have our own personality traits. So if I have anxiety, if I tend to experience more anxiety, this will result in problems in intermuscular and intermuscular coordination. So this will result in inefficient movements, which then will lead to increased probability of having injuries. If I am too anxious, then this may result in a tunnel vision. So this means that my attentional field will be so narrow that I will lose important information, important cues in the environment. It's just like imagine that you have a flashlight that you control the focus, the beam. So if you have a tunnel vision, you will only pay attention to what's inside that beam. And that means that you are not going to scan the environment appropriately. So therefore, you may be losing information. Like, say, for example, someone coming in your direction and to tackle you, for example, if you're a rugby player. So these types of things, so these personality traits may lead to states of anxiety that then interfere with their ability to pick up information from the environment and their ability to have an efficient movement execution. And also, if I have a tendency to experience, evaluate the situations as threatening, so everything is a concern, so while I'm focused on how afraid I am, how threatening the situation is, so this means that my mind is cluttered with negative self-talk, is cluttered with ruminative thoughts. So I keep thinking about the mistake I did 10 minutes ago. That will not allow me to pay attention to the environment. So this results in increased heart rate, for example, muscle tension, so physiological changes, and also cognitive changes in terms of the inability to scan the environment. Then yeah, I am more open, or I am more likely to receive or to suffer an injury.
It's like I just watched The Last Dance there a few weeks ago. Myself and Ben were talking about this off air, or maybe it was on air, I'm unsure, last week or the week before. And it was kind of giving it was profiling Michael Jordan, who arguably could have been maybe is one of the best basketballers ever to have played in the NBA. But one of his quotes was, or one of his sayings in that documentary series was, why would I worry about a shot that I haven't taken already? You know, so he's mm-hmm. he's managing stress. He's a cober in a lot of ways. And a lot of ways you were talking about stress being the way you interact with your environment, and so your relationship with that actual specific either a game or maybe you've got some stuff going on in the background and all that. And then you touched a little bit on the muscle physiology. So if I'm stressed, have they done some research on muscle? Have they taken some muscle biopsies? Have they shown a reduction in force output? You know, what, like with regards to if there is a change in muscle physiology, and if that is a negative change, how do I know it's a negative change? And what are the consequences of changing the physiology of the muscle? I.e., you know, am I operating suboptimally? Am I going to be slower? Am I going to fatigue quicker? Is there research on that?
In terms of the muscle physiology per se, I'm not aware. I didn't look into that into this physiological aspect. There is some research that if you are stressed, you are using your energy's resources quickly. But what I see more frequently is kinematic and cinematic aspects of or parameters of the movements, where there is a lack of coordination between agonistic and antagonistic muscles, and this results in very inefficient technique, for example. So those are very meaningful results. In terms of physiology, as I said, I'm not acquainted with that part of the literature, but we know that the stress results in increase of cortisol, which then interferes with a variety of physiological processes, and this cortisol is associated with stress. I think that, as I said, I prefer not to expand more on this particular aspect because I'm not really acquainted with the literature on the physiological processes.
I have one last interrogative question, and so. You might not be able to answer this question now, so you know the gents might have other questions for you. You might want to have a little bit of a think of it and maybe mm-hmm. answer at the end of the show. But if you were to recommend one life-changing book, right? Obviously, you want to say your own research first, okay? Mm-hmm. So let's put aside your research for the moment, and maybe one paper that you've written, okay, and one book that would really help. Doesn't matter whether you're an athlete or not an athlete, but if you're going to, and I think the crux of our conversation is how you manage stress, you know, how you view the world and your relationship with it, how you manage that, and then moving forwards to be able to optimally perform in all parts of your life, whether it's sport or relationship or work or even sleep, you know, being able to do that. Is there a book that you would recommend, our resource and one of your papers that our readers could kind of go and say, all right, I'll have a look at that?
Well, in terms of book, I mean, there is one, The Chimp Paradox. I think it's probably one book that puts it lays out very nicely in a non-technical language these processes of how we are allowing sometimes just by the way we think and by the way we process information, how we are allowing the stress to take over. So that's probably a really nice book to start.
Well, you go ahead.
Now, in terms of one of my papers, that's probably more challenging because I don't tend to think like that in terms of my papers. So that was quite a. Let me see what of the papers.
While you're doing that, I just want to say, yeah. I'm so glad that you mentioned the Chimp Paradox now, and I'm going to be a little bit ruthless here now, and I shouldn't probably do this, but so the Chimp Paradox is written by Steve Peters. Mm-hmm. Now, I have written a book on sporting physiology and sporting injuries, and I asked Steve, would he write a chapter on sports psychology in the mm-hmm. book? And he kindly said yes, because I had read the Chimp Paradox and I quite liked it because it was something that I could also pass on to athletes and parents and coaches and just how to manage the chimp, you know what I mean? Is the human talking or is the chimp talking? Is this emotion or is this kind of reasoning? And Dr. Anna Waters, who's part of the chimp management team, so she wrote a chapter in the book that which will be published in the next couple of months. So I can certainly say that, yeah, I would agree with you that the Chimp Paradox, and there are plenty books like that, let's be honest, you know yes. what I mean? It's a nice, easy one to start with for sure. So I would agree with you there. I think that's a good one for listeners. We might put that in the show notes. And still, if we can give a shout out to Dr. Anna Waters and we put in Elsevier and the name of the book that's coming out in the next couple of months as well, that'd be pretty good. So, and then onto your piece of writing that maybe might help maybe clinicians, parents, coaches, whatever.
Yeah, no, well, probably I would say one of the two 2020 papers on mindfulness Yeah, exactly. The paper that was led by Naderi and his colleagues from Iran, myself, and Britton Brewer from the US, because it points out how mindfulness can actually help athletes to maintain their attentional control and to reduce their anxiety levels, and that means that their tendency to suffer injuries is reduced.
True story here, right? And I'm sure we'll probably get the player on. Actually, what we'll do, Jens, is I'll invite this player on because he won't mind discussing this. But I worked with him previously. Let's say now we're going back a few years now, obviously, right? And professional footballer in professional football league, and you know, he played two or three seasons while I was the head physio at this particular club. He left the club and went to another club, and subsequently ended up with chronic groin pain. And he had a number of interventions. He had surgery, he had injections. And this was ongoing for 2 years while he was away at that club. Then he came back. He got re-signed by the club I was at. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh my God, the guy hasn't played for 2 years and he's had everything. And I said to the manager, I said, look, I just don't think this is probably going to work. So we had a good sit down. We had a good chat with this player. Now, remember, he's well known to me at this stage, you know, because I'd worked with him previously, gone away. We'd spoken about it. And he had literally, you know, he was a very compliant guy as well, worked really hard in the gym, had told me how much he'd done. So he had exhausted every single opportunity that was out there from him. A physiological point of view and mm-hmm. an intervention point of view, from neuropathic drugs to injection therapy to invasive surgery and so on and so forth. So I said to him, look, I think this is chronic pain. This is, you know, we're dealing with a pain response here, and you know, it's like there's a lot of anxiety related to this. This is your job and so on and so forth. So we went down the route of mindfulness, and we went down the route of that 10-minute, I can't remember what it's called again, but what's the with the orange dot in it, Headspace. And we literally just worked on Headspace, mindfulness, for, I would say, he'll know, I'd have to have my notes in front of me, but I think it was over a space of, as short as 8 weeks following 2 years of having been removed from training and playing. Couldn't train, couldn't play because of debilitating groin pain. We worked on mindfulness together, two of us, because it was kind of, you know, again, going back a few years, so it was kind of new to me as well, and I was getting my head around this kind of space, really. And within 8 weeks, he was back training and playing, and never missed a game or training because of groin pain, but was able to manage the pain. Yep. You know, so you know, the pain levels reduced. He was able to comprehend that he had coping strategies with regard to breathing strategies, and he was also kind of, we did a lot of education around pain science. So we went down the Melzack route, so we looked at that mature organism model and neurosignature, and the more education and the more mindfulness we did, the more effective the interventions from training became. And then he got back to training and playing. So it was a real eye opener for me. It was excellent for him. He tells everybody. So I'm not worried about telling the story. I'm obviously not going to say his name because I need to protect patient confidentiality. But what we might actually do is, as a follow up to this, is we might get this player on the podcast, and he can share his experience rather than me doing a piss poor job on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an excellent example, quite a dramatic example of how a different strategy works so nicely for an athlete. And I think that the key, I think you pointed out the really key point, which is the managing. It's just the idea that what I like about the mindfulness is that you just avoid judging the things that are happening. So, for example, earlier you asked about the goal-directed self-talk. These types of strategies, these very cognitive strategies, are very demanding from an energy point of view. So you actually have to constantly try to control and change. And mindfulness does not focus on that. It's just, it's here. My self-doubts are here, but I still can perform well, rather than I don't feel confident for this game. That's terrible. Well, I don't feel confident for this game, but I still can perform well. So this idea of that you don't have to fight those negative thoughts. You just accept them. And that when you do that, you allow your mental processes to focus on what is really important.
Life is about acceptance, nothing is good or nothing is bad, only what you perceive it to be. And then if you can accept it and you can acknowledge it, then, you know, and you can do something about it from your perspective, you know. Yeah. And I guess the stress comes when you're not able to accept something, whether it's personal or professional, or it's, you know, it goes against your blueprint. So your blueprint might be, look, you know, I should be the center back in this team, or, you know, my family life should look like this, or I didn't picture myself ever with this type of injury. Maybe it's an ACL injury or an ankle injury. Mm-hmm. And you're so far removed from what you feel is your blueprint or the norm, and you just can't accept it. So you've got all this kind of stress going on in your life. And then yeah. when you start practicing mindfulness and kind of look at a level of acceptance, it's, you know, things tend to settle down. And I guess what we're trying to do in the world at the moment is not die with coronavirus, but learn to live with coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, that's a bit of acceptance as well going on there, isn't it?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. That's a very good point.
Absolutely. Listen, that's all the questions that are for me. Louis, this has been phenomenal. Very, very interesting. I'm sure that coaches and athletes and, you know, sports scientists and physios will have got an awful lot out of this. If, you know, I would highly recommend that people get in touch with you if they work with athletes, and going down the route of mindfulness for me personally and professionally, working with athletes, and then for my own self, managing athletes, you know, the stress that they give you. It was a game changer for me. The chimp paradox is pretty good. That's why I got in touch with Steve Peters, and Anna Waters wrote in the chapter. So I think it's any one of those books like that is good. You know, we're not just kind of singling out one book here. Yeah, thank you so much for that. So I'm going to hand you over to my learned colleagues, my esteemed colleagues.
Thanks, Johnny. Brilliant. Louis, I promised to go a little bit easier on you than Johnny there. So you first, sort of the work that you've been carrying out, you know, it first registered on my radar in the beginning of April, when several of the main sort of media outlets picked up on a research study that you had just completed. And that was linked to mindfulness training linked to reduction in football injuries. And I did have a line of questioning that I was going to go down. But just listening to yourself and Johnny discussing the techniques and the strategies that you are implementing and certainly working with young people, I got the thought that was the original study or was the idea and the concept for the study, was that geared around, you know, developing skills to improve performance for the young athletes, or, you know, was it about learning those transferable skills, you know, to help those young people become more well-rounded? And, you know, is the injury reduction, was that a byproduct of the actual work that you were doing? Or was it always about, you know, how can we look to reduce injuries within sport?
Yes, that the study was designed, was about to reduce the injuries in sports. So it was specifically designed to compare mindfulness, the effect of mindfulness on the reduction of injuries. Compare with a educational based sports psychology type of intervention. Well, it's not really intervention; it's a control. It was designed to reduce the injuries. Any effect on athletes' ability to use mindfulness in other contexts of their lives was not measured. That was not the purpose of this study.
Yeah. So in terms of, because in a former and a past life, I was actually a careers advisor, So the majority of my work was carried out with 16 to 18 and 16 to 19 year olds, and we'd done goal setting strategy and mindfulness concepts. And what we always struggled with within a particular school environment was it was the buy-in from young people. Now, obviously, the collaborative study that you put together with the three Iranian institutions and in the US college at Springfield, in terms of the study groups that you engage with, presumably those young people, were open and accepted of the work, and they had sort of full buy-in in collaboration with yourselves, you know, to really see the impact of that research.
Yes, actually, the clubs were recruited by the Iranian Football Association. So there was a lot of support. There was a lot of support for Anola to conduct those studies. I mean, there's more than one. This particular study, it was fairly. I wouldn't say easy, but it was very successful in increasing the interest or raising the interest in this study, definitely. And you raised an issue that is really important, which is the buy-in. If the athletes, doesn't really trust that this is an appropriate strategy, regardless if it's mindfulness or any other type of intervention, if the athlete is not motivated, does not think that it's something that's going to be helpful, it's not likely that the interventions will work. So there's an element of providing some degree of education for these things to work out. Of course, in research, that becomes a little bit more complicated because you don't want to manipulate expectations. But I think that the way this study was designed by the Iranian colleagues was really well designed. It was very good.
Yeah, and looking at those results, fairly simplistically, just in terms of the numbers, we've seen quite a dramatic decrease in or difference between the number of reported injury incidents. I think it was over 40%, and certainly in terms of the number of days lost mm-hmm. to injury, it was significant as well. I mean, did those numbers surprise you in a way in terms of maybe the effectiveness of the work that you had been doing?
Well, we were expecting something like that. There's the work of Iverson already indicated that mindfulness could be very very useful. It was a bit surprising, definitely, that the impact of the intervention on the number of injuries, but we also wanted to look at through which mechanisms this take place. These decreases in the injury are fairly well known at this point, but it was still unclear what were the mechanisms that led to those decreases. So that's why the psychological aspects of the psychological component of the measurement, that's why these were introduced. And again, the results are similar to what we expect, and that's what we have seen in the literature, which is the athletes were more able to maintain concentration. The athletes decreased their perception of stress. They decreased their state anxiety, so therefore they were more available to engage in the here and now of the competition. I think those are really interesting results that actually open another another area of research in terms of the mindfulness, because we need to more clearly define how mindfulness impacts the rate of injury, because it can't be a direct effect. It needs to be a moderating effect. It needs to be through the psychological mechanisms and eventually the physiological mechanisms as well. That would be something that would be really useful to look at.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I've actually read the research paper, and it was as we were promoting the podcast, we'll actually send out the links, and we'll have to get you a little bit more active on social media, Louis, so you can field any questions which are sent your way. But that's been absolutely brilliant. Like I say, I really appreciate your thoughts and your insights. Stelle, do you have anything to chip in with? Or?
No, I'd just like to say thank you, Louis, for joining us. Really appreciate your time, mate. And hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Well, it was my pleasure. So thank you very much for your invitation.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louis. Cheers. Really, really wonderful. Appreciate that, mate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great stuff.
Thank you, Louis.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you very much for your questions.
You're very welcome. Am I muted or can you hear me, guys?
No, we can hear you. You're driving though, aren't you?
Okay. All right, sorry. I'm mute. Thank you, Louis, you are a legend. I really enjoyed that. I'm into all this kind of stuff anyway. I believe in it as a person, wholeheartedly. Every cell of me believes in it. And I guess the last thing I should really put in with regards to that player, he had tried everything else, so he had no choice but believe in mindfulness, because he had no other avenues. And to me, you know, for me, I used that as well. I said, look, you know, what else is there left? What else can you turn to? You have to turn to you now. Your strategies have been on everybody else, have been reliant on imaging for a diagnosis, have been reliant on surgeons for a quick fix. I've been reliant on medication for reduction of pain symptoms. Have been reliant on, I guess, clinicians for dosing of exercise to improve tissue mechanics. But really, the answer lay within him on how he was able to manage his environment, his relationship with the environment, and then his own body as well. And to be fair, he did it brilliantly. Like, he wholeheartedly committed to this situation. But I guess he had no choice. So if we had started mindfulness at the start of his journey, he might have gone, nah, not for me, bro. I'd rather go for the surgery. But I'm sure he'll answer that on a future podcast anyway.
Yep, it's very important to raise athletes' expectations, definitely.
Great stuff. Well, Luis, again, thank you for joining us, mate. Really appreciate it. And you enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louis.
Bye.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Louis. Thank you, Louis.
Right, gentlemen. Twitter handles. Ben.
Just unmuting myself there. It's at Ben Dinnery, and also a new Instagram channel that I'm looking to push so selflessly at the moment, which is Premier_injuries.
Premier_injuries. I'm going to go on it right now. Premier. Let's see if it exists. It's not one of those accounts where they follow you and then it says, like, link in my bio and it's only fans or something like that.
I hope not. I never actually set up
I followed it yesterday. It's pretty easy to get onto. It's just Premier_injuries. So I had a look at it. Benji's got some fresh trim going on there, boy.
The lockdown look.
Trim
to the bone.
If you haven't seen it, guys, you want to get on there, and then you would put your lunch money away because it's probably going. And when you see him, you know exactly what I mean. Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Right, we're on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. We also have an Instagram. You're going to see my mug on it. Johnny, your Twitter handle, please.
Fuck that. I don't put anything good on Twitter anymore.
where the magic is happening now is on YouTube and in kind of Instagram. Yeah, no, Instagram, but YouTube and Instagram. So Nottingham Physio on YouTube. So put up all, and it's a resource really for athletes, for, you know, if you're injured and stuff like that. And then the same way with Instagram, I think it's Knots_Physio. So I'm either hanging out there or I'm hanging out on YouTube. But it's mainly a YouTube journey, hopefully, now for me for the next few years. YouTube, Instagram, and see how we go. Not that I've got anything against Twitter, but I'm just, in fact, I'm bored of people kind of, oh, I read this and you're wrong and you read this, oh, fuck off. Man. So, yeah, just making magic on YouTube, guys.
And that was Johnny's short answer. So until next time, ladies and gents, goodbye.